Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. A quick reminder before we get started, any advice provided by Brandon is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives, so consider whether it's appropriate for you. Brandon van der Kolk is authorized to provide general financial product advice in Australia and is authorized representative number 1305795 of Guideway Financial Services Proprietary Limited, AFSL number 420367. Please see the description box for Brandon's financial services guide. Past performance is not a reliable indication of future investment returns. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, Hamish, there he is. Hello, sipping hello, on his coffee.
Yep. I've been
how you going, mate?
Yeah, I'm going well. I've been enjoying having just like little, I'm trying to like show it for people who are listening with, or watching with video. I'm having like these like little coffees now because I don't like drinking a lot of milk. So, and I've been drinking a lot of coffee recently. So if I was making like normal coffees, that'd just be like way too much milk. So yeah.
How many coffees are you drinking a day?
Be honest. So it fluctuates a lot, but like it goes like, I'll go through periods where I'm having like one in the morning. That's like my lowest. I never have no coffee. It's always like one in the morning.
You have a coffee at one in the morning?
No, one coffee. One coffee. Yeah. Six at 1 a.m. No. I'll go, that's like the best I could possibly get is like one in the morning. At the moment, it's like 6 to 8. Which is bad. It's bad. But then it goes to a period where it just doesn't, more coffee just like doesn't do anything. And then it goes back down. So yeah.
Wow.
It's bad. I go through these like 2 week cycles.
Are you like a coffee connoisseur? Do you like your filtered coffee and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Chemex and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I do still have a Chemex. I used to use it. I don't really use it anymore. I have a Breville espresso machine, which I love.
So, George Clooney would be disappointed.
Yeah. No $2 pods.
No.
Yeah. No, it's actually pretty cheap. If you're the coffee I get, I just get the Woolworths coffee. I do like getting special, it's like specialty coffee beans sometimes, but the Woolies coffee is like $12 a kilo. So like as just a go-to bean, and it's a good coffee machine, so it makes good coffee. So,
all right. There you go.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. I'm at my peak coffee intake.
You're right on the limit. I don't know anything about coffee because here's a fun fact. I've never had a cup of coffee ever in my life.
What? Wait,
my
never.
28 years of existence. Yeah, wait, I've had a sip.
I knew
because Yeah, I've had a sip here and there. And sometimes I don't mind the smell when you walk into a cafe and it smells like coffee, but then I drink, I have a little sip of coffee and I'm like, yep, still don't like it. My problem is I don't like drinks that are bitter.
Yeah.
So there's something deep in my brain that says if I'm drinking a liquid and it's bitter, I don't like it. So I don't even like beer. So I don't like coffee. I don't like beer. I don't know what other bitter drinks there are out there, but I don't like any of them.
That makes sense.
I got a sweet tooth.
You do drink caffeine though, right? Like you drink like Coke and that
So. Yeah, like my caffeine is usually just like Pepsi Max.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So there you go. Fun fact about me.
Yeah.
Crazy. I'm very much in the minority, I think, especially in Australia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Australian coffee culture is, it's hectic. It's great. I remember every time we go over to the US, it's always like, I have to go to like Starbucks because it's the only place that has like reasonable,
in the US,
reasonable coffee.
This is disgusting.
Okay, I didn't do that. Take it back. Make it again.
Yeah, you did. I remember you slammed it back on the, you threw it in the guy's face you slammed your cup back up. No.
And here's the video.
I'm on a mission to get Hamish cancelled.
No, but yeah, Americans, they haven't quite figured out how to make good coffee yet.
A clip. I'm clipping that. I'm going to use that against you sometime.
Uh-oh.
All right, Hamish, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, we've got a nice basket of different pieces of news. I've got a bunch of things, central bank and economic news that I've bundled together, as I've done a couple of times just to so we don't spend too much time on each of them. Some news from Jamie Dimon. He's selling a lot of stock. He's dumping shares. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about Disney and their deal with Comcast, who they're kind of reaching an agreement around Hulu, the streaming service, which both of them own. And what have you got?
I'm going to be talking about Saudi Arabia jumping in and potentially hosting the 2034 Soccer World Cup. And right. Also, one of my favorite companies, SpaceX, has just won, and ULA has won some more Space Force rocket launches, which is interesting. Wow. So we'll talk about that as well.
Awesome. Well, with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks, view buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings, and manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days. And you can also get a $50 off coupon if it's your first time signing up. So go check it out. And yeah, as always, thanks to those who have used that link when signing up and are supporting the podcast.
Supporting the podcast. How is that for an intro? 6 minutes-ish. Some people get a bit angry at us at the start of the episode because we talk a little bit too long about random stuff. But with that said, let's keep this thing moving, Hamish. I feel under pressure now. I've got to keep this thing moving. Let's talk about this economic central bank news. There's fair few things that came out this week.
I feel like it was only like a couple of weeks ago. I feel like I did another, I compiled a bunch of economic news and there's just more. There's always stuff.
Here we go again.
There's always stuff coming out. And I guess that kind of happens if you're covering US, Australia, and sometimes the UK and Europe, then there's always going to be something coming out. But, we'll start, most of this news is out of the US. So we'll start in the US. We got economic growth data out of the US, so GDP, gross domestic product, which measures the total value of goods and services produced. We got the quarterly figure for the third quarter. GDP grew by 4.9% year over year, adjusted for inflation, which is a massive increase up from 2.1% in Q2. 4.9%. Adjusted for inflation, which is, I don't actually know specifically which figure they use, but I presume like headline figure. So that means nominal GDP growth was like 8%, which is crazy.
That's hectic. Man, the US is the new China.
Yeah.
And China's the new US.
Yeah, not quite. It does seem like it is just going to be a single quarter of excess growth, but it is the fastest quarterly rate since Q4 of 2021, 2021, of course, being a period of massive growth because it came after 2020 when there was actually a decline, when there was an actual kind of retraction. Yeah. Most of the increase was driven by a 4% increase in consumer spending. So that accounted for a little over half of the total growth. Consumer spending is a very large piece of GDP growth. But it was also driven by growth in other important areas, increased company inventories, so companies spending money, building up their inventories, that contributed, it was like 1.3 percentage points out of the 4.9%. Domestic investment surged 8.4%. So again, businesses investing in the future of their companies, that surged significantly. And then government spending and investment as well also is a part of the total GDP. That was up 4.6% year over year. So, just great, pretty much strong growth across the board. Government spending more, businesses are spending more, businesses increasing their inventories. And then most importantly, consumers kind of went crazy towards the end of the American summer. through the American summer, I should say.
I don't know. It's a good sign, I guess. It's a good sign considering what we've been dealing with the last couple of years.
It's kind of funny, right? Because like, on one hand, it's like, yeah, it's good, they're growing, but then it's also, well, the economy is still hot, So it's like, is the Fed then going to raise rates? Yeah, it's like, it's funny. It's like good news is bad news now. And bad news is good news. It's like, oh, they grew slowly. Good. The Fed's not going to raise. It's so weird how expectations are kind of work in that way. But yeah, it's
a good point.
It is certainly good to see that the economy is obviously healthy. It's good that it didn't retract. That's for sure. But yeah, as I mentioned, growth was kind of somewhat of an anomaly in Q3. Growth is expected to slow back down to 1.2% for Q4 for next quarter. Which is pretty much where growth has been. Very, very slow once you're accounting for inflation.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's kind of the first piece of news I wanted to start with. And then kind of following on from that and pretty much kind of related to that, we got the Fed decision for what they're going to do with interest rates, which, of course, a big part of their decision is, you know, how hot is the economy? What's the jobs market like? What's inflation like? And so with the economy growing really strong and inflation still there and jobs market being strong, there was a lot of people who thought that the Fed may return to rate hikes. They've kind of been pausing for a little while. But they didn't. They continued to keep their rates steady at the range of 5.25% to 5.5%.
Because inflation the last few months has been on a little kickback. It went down to 3%,
yep.
And it's gone back up to, where is it now? I think it's like at 3.7. Is that right? Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
It has been a bit stubborn. So yeah, there was a lot of eyes on what the Fed was going to do.
Yeah.
And especially with what you're talking about before, with the economy just on a bit of a tear and also with all the labor numbers being very strong, a lot of people were almost expecting that the Fed might go one level higher and raise rates again. But yeah, there you go. They've just decided to hold steady and see what happens for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually didn't grab the inflation data. I think they actually were released over the last week as well, if I'm not mistaken.
You keep talking, I'll have a look.
Yeah, I'll keep talking. You pull that up and we can look at that at the same time as the Fed decision. Yeah, there was just so much economic news. I can't believe I missed that one, but there were so many little pieces. So we got a kind of a quote from Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed. As usual, he said, the process of getting inflation sustainably down to 2% has a long way to go. Fed Chair Jerome Powell said in remarks at a news conference, he stressed that the central bank hadn't made any decisions yet for its December meeting, saying that, quote, the committee will always do what it thinks is appropriate at the time. So they're not giving any clues as to what they're going to do in December, which of course will be the last rate meeting for the year. Although Powell has been saying for quite some time that they would like to do one more hike this year. So there's a chance that they hike. Of course, there's a chance they continue to hold rates steady, but it wouldn't be surprising, I think, if there was a little 25 basis point hike in the last month.
I got your number for you, Hamish. It remained at 3.7
right.
in September.
Okay.
Yeah. The headline. July was 3.2. Yeah, just headline. 3.2, then it jumped 3.7, and it's remained at 3.7.
Right. Okay.
For headline.
Cool. Yeah. There you go. So nothing too exciting. Nothing too crazy. Yeah, I mean, it's starting to – it's getting down there. But yeah, as we've kind of mentioned,
I mean, it's down – it's come down, obviously, a long, long way. But it's still just – annoyingly above where it needs to be.
Yeah,
it's like that, just the last bit. Just a little bit. It's like, do we just need to get that last little bit?
Yeah.
But that's all right.
That hopefully, last bit is very hard. Very, very hard to get down. Especially because inflation has been high for so long. So there is some entrenched kind of expectation of higher inflation, and that just keeps people spending a little bit more than they might usually.
It's very psychological, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Japan had the opposite, right? They had deflation for so long that people expected prices to go down so they would hold off their spending because they were going to get it cheaper next year.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a bit of a psychological cycle as well, inflation and deflation. That's another aspect to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Fed holding rates steady. They've held rates steady since July now. So, we're in November. So it's been quite some time. And as a result of that, we've seen short-term U.S. government bond rates pretty much just be flat since then. So the Fed has pretty direct control over short-term government bond rates. They pretty much just sit slightly above the federal funds rate, which is what the Fed changes. But the Fed doesn't directly control long interest rates. And those rates have been rising a lot recently. So the 10-year, for example, and this is related to a story that I'm going to talk about in a second, the 10-year bond rate surged from 3% in April to 5%, which might not seem like a huge amount, but it means that bond prices are down about 15% this year. And since 2020 now, long bond rates are down 50%, which is kind of crazy.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you consider a bond or a United States Treasury bond, you know, what do you hear about US Treasury bonds? How do people describe them? They're super safe. They're stable. They're for risk averse investors. And yeah, if they bought long bonds in 2020, they're staring down the barrel of a 50% loss on paper, of course, because you don't have to sell your bonds. You can just wait it out and let them hit their maturity. But yeah, if you wanted to trade them, you're looking at taking a 50% loss.
Yeah.
Hectic.
But even if they don't sell them, they're sitting on fixed income of 0.5% for a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, which is, you know, why the bond prices have gone down so much. You're kind of locked into this terrible this terrible deal while there's a massive opportunity cost that comes with that. It's been a crazy market, especially recently though. Long bonds have been surging recently. And that really comes down to kind of different supply and demand changes that happen on long bonds. It's not directly controlled by the Fed. And part of that is the US's debt problem, right? So the US has $33 trillion in debt. They have a $1.4 trillion deficit. So every single year, not only do they have a huge debt pile that kind of rolls over, every single year they're spending more money, or they're still spending more money than they're collecting in tax revenue. So they constantly need to sell new bonds just to function, right? So they're constantly writing new bonds. And that means that supply is just outpacing demand and bond yields rise. And that has real consequences, right? Because then it pushes up yields on everything. It pushes up corporate debt. It pushes up mortgages. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage in the US just hit 8%. So even though the Fed isn't raising rates, stuff is getting more, dual debt, let's say, is getting more expensive across the board for households, for the government, for businesses. And this week, we got an update around this problem specifically. So the Treasury Department, which is responsible for issuing and selling bonds, announced plans to accelerate the size of its bond auctions, of its bond selling, to handle its debt load and financing costs. So this week they announced we are actually going to be increasing the amount that we're needing to sell. So the Treasury will auction $112 billion in debt next week to refund $102 billion of notes that are maturing on November 15, raising more than $9 billion in extra funds. So you've got $102 billion that's rolling off. So not only are they just replacing old debt with new debt, which is, you know, one problem in of itself, but they're having to also increase the amount that they're replacing it with, which is the accelerating debt problem. It's, you know, it's one thing to just, you know, let your debt expire and then replace it with new debt. That's one problem. You know, debt that was at a low interest rate that's now going on to a higher interest rate. But the actual dollar amount as well is also going up, which is a part of the reason why yields are rising. So specifically, the Treasury expects the increase for sizes for 2 and 5 year notes to be $3 billion a month, 3 year notes by $2 billion a month, 7 year notes by $1 billion a month. So by the end of January, auction sizes will show respective increases of $9 billion, $9 billion, $6 billion, and $3 billion across the different debt issuances.
Which is
you're talking about, you know, big numbers. It actually means in Q1 of 2024, the US government will need to borrow $816 billion, which means, and that's a recurring. So that means for the first time, they've passed the $800 billion mark every quarter in new debt. Which is an astounding figure. It's over $3 billion, $3 trillion, $3 trillion with a T a year.
Holy.
So, it's
enough for some massive.
it is kind of funny because we are talking to big numbers, so they're obviously going to be big regardless of whether it's good or bad. But I can firmly say that that's quite bad.
Wow.
So yeah, How the government plans to deal with this, I don't really know. You know, potentially they'll raise taxes or cut spending. But we'll just have to see. Yeah, the biggest problem, I think, or the short-term problem is they still have this deficit. So, you know, before we even think about the...
Get your Ray Dalio hat on.
yeah, exactly. Before you even think about the $33 trillion in debt, like, let's assume that that's fine. We could just, you know, just leave that there. They can't be continuing to spend more than they're collecting in tax revenue. So how they decide to fix that, I don't know. But that's why yields are rising. It's why mortgage rates are going up. It's why corporate debt's going up. And it's also potentially why the stock market has been falling recently. Yields on stocks also kind of go up. So like the return people demand on stocks goes up. And for that to happen, prices need to come down a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, what do they do about it, Hamish? Because I guess they've either got like the fundamental problem here is that they run a massive deficit.
Yes.
So they have to keep plugging the hole with debt. So yeah. The number one thing they have to do is fix the deficit. They have to try and aim for a surplus.
Yep.
Which means they have to increase their income.
Yeah.
And they do that by raising taxes, or they have to cut their spending.
Yeah.
And they cut their spending on, you know, infrastructure or
Or the economy grows and therefore taxes increase because businesses are producing more, which is over time how the government deals with this problem. But exactly, the productivity. But the question is, you know, can they grow their way out of this problem? Maybe not. Maybe this is a situation where expenses kind of ran up too fast and they do need to come off, or taxes need to go up, which is the other way that the government has historically dealt with this, right? You see a lot of people campaigning for that, you know, increasing taxes on the rich, increasing taxes on, you know, stock options and that sort of thing, capital gains or share buybacks. There's all of these different ways that that money can be found.
Joe Biden will be standing up. Well, if you look at our last quarter of economic growth,
exactly, we're fine.
4.9% outpacing adjusted for inflation.
He pulls a Musk. We'll do 50% growth indefinitely.
Indefinitely, yeah, exactly. Oh dear. Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah.
Just let's put Ray Dalio in the presidential position and see what he can do. Just leave it up to him, I say.
Yeah. Yeah.
I reckon that's the easiest solution.
It would be interesting to see like how that, like in an alternate reality, like if that happened, how would the economy look if like, because he, you know, he has a lot to say about how things should be done.
Yeah.
But you don't really know if, you know, how it would actually play out if those things were implemented.
Well, I think it'll work. I mean, the stuff he says, obviously it makes sense. He knows what he's talking about. I think the thing that Ray would struggle with is being political about it all, because I mean, at the end of the day, what's his number one takeaway? His number one point to fix the problem is to increase your productivity. And really what increasing your productivity is saying to everybody, we need to work harder. Like, we need, with the same resources, we need to do more.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, true. So that would be interesting, his messaging around telling people that they just need to work harder.
Yeah.
But if we all work harder together, I know you're struggling.
Yeah.
Nah, yeah. I reckon he'd do a good job as president. Economically, he'd do very well. I don't know about socially.
Yeah, who knows about other? I don't really know what he thinks about all the other things. So
yeah. I'd vote for him still. I love the guy.
Mm.
What a guy!
What a guy!
Ray Dalio. What a guy! What a guy! All right. What else you got?
Yeah, that's it for economics news. A couple of things. I'll just give one line on. Bank of England held their rates steady, so they decided not to increase.
Really?
And Eurozone inflation grew slower than expected. Which is obviously good news, but that's it. I won't.
Only 10%.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were expecting 19 and it was 18.9.
Yeah. Oh, it's slower than expected inflation.
Yeah.
That's lower rates.
Yeah. That's all I've got. That's my economic news.
That's all you've got.
Yeah, that's it.
I would have thought you'd have more, mate.
How we do? How long was that? That felt really long.
No, that was good. It was like 15 minutes.
Okay.
Well, there was a lot to talk about in there.
Yeah.
That was a good discussion.
There's been a lot going on.
All right. Well, let me talk about, we'll go from the dense and complex world of economics and central banks to soccer.
The fun world of soccer.
sounds good.
Yeah.
I found this interesting. I didn't realize that the soccer World Cup is much the same as it's in much the same situation as the Olympics. You know how just no one wants to host the Olympics anymore because it's just too expensive, doesn't generate enough revenue? I didn't realize the Soccer World Cup's like kind of in the same boat. I guess it makes sense, but I don't know. There's just so many. Like, I think the Olympics struggles because at the end of the day, like, no one cares. It's like no one's turning on the TV every weekend to watch swimming or to watch 100-meter sprinting. But they are turning on the TV to watch Arsenal or to watch Manchester United or something like that.
I guess this is like there's probably more infrastructure, or definitely more infrastructure involved in the Olympics, I would imagine. Like maybe a city wouldn't have the variety of arenas that they need. Whereas maybe a place has the soccer pitches, but then I guess you still need a number of places to allow teams to play at the same time, right? So I guess it is still just this big potential infrastructure project for a lot of places.
Yeah, exactly right. But yeah, sorry, back to the story. The story is that Saudi Arabia looks set to host the 2034 World Cup after the only other country to have shown an interest in hosting, which was Australia, made a last-minute decision not to bid. The quote here is, "We've reached the conclusion not to do so for the 2034 competition," a statement from Football Australia said Tuesday, just hours before FIFA's deadline for declarations of interest. It puts Saudi Arabia on track to host the global soccer tournament a decade from now, a move that's likely to be seen as highly controversial. It would also make it only the second Arab Gulf country to ever host the World Cup after Qatar did so in 2022. And for context as to what we were talking about earlier, how much money are we looking at here? So a couple of World Cups ago, it was in Brazil. They spent $15 billion. Then Russia had it in 2018. They spent $11.6 billion. But this is where it gets a little bit nuts. Qatar spent 15 times more. They spent $220 billion.
Wow.
$220 billion for the Soccer World Cup. Was it this year or last year? I can't remember.
That's crazy. Last year.
Yeah,
that is insane. Geez, so they have to build a whole city? Like,
yeah, pretty much. But I think it's going to be much the same for Saudi Arabia. They're going to have to do similar kind of investment. You know, Brazil, everyone plays soccer in Brazil. I don't know about Russia, but they must have the facilities. But I feel Saudi Arabia are going to dump a lot of money into it. And obviously from a social standpoint, the selection of Qatar as host angered many human rights activists who accused the state abusing migrant workers, endangering the lives of the LGBT community, and stifling free speech. Qatar pushed back by insisting that everyone was welcome in the country and denying reports that thousands of workers had died building the stadiums, but it said that it was entitled to set its own laws. Some fans were also frustrated at the location as the World Cup took place in the winter due to the Gulf region's soaring summer temperatures. The 2030 FIFA World Cup, meanwhile, will be hosted by Morocco, Spain, and Portugal, with three opening matches to be played in South America.
Right.
Saudi Arabia is criticized for its well-documented human rights violations, abuses of women's rights, and criminalization of homosexuality. Amnesty International reported that Saudi Arabia in 2022 oversaw the highest number of yearly executions in 30 years. Wowee, with 196 people killed. I did not know that. In response to an interview question about the kingdom's human rights abuses, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed. Okay, this is getting definitely into more of the social context more than the economic context, but I'll run with it anyway. Saudi Crown Prince even, Mohammed bin Salman, said there are bad laws in the country he does not like, but that he cannot interfere with the judiciary. Saudi observers and rights activists have rejected that assertion. The kingdom's multi-billion-dollar investment into sports and international sports events of the last few years, parts of its Vision 2030 project aimed at diversifying its economy away from oil, has been described as sports washing by human rights groups. This is more of the interesting stuff I wanted to talk about. To that, the Saudi leader said he doesn't care and is happy to continue sports washing if it increases his country's GDP.
Right.
Between early 2021 and June of 2023, the kingdom spent $6.1 billion on sports investments, an analysis by The Guardian found. So This is an interesting play. I think it's going to cost Saudi Arabia a lot of money to get themselves ready, but it's interesting that it fits into their bigger picture of getting themselves away from oil. And we've seen this as well. I don't know if you follow any YouTube channels at the moment that I follow have been talking about their massive investment building like these new mega projects like The Line and there's like a ski field high-end resort and there's like a shipping on the water shipping city that they're building with massive ports. There's like so many mega projects happening in Saudi.
Yeah, so they have so much money. It's like not even, we talk about the richest people. You look at the richest people in the world list and it's all just like kind of Americans and that sort of thing. But like if some of these guys were on those lists. Like if there was actual detailed like accounting of their finances, some of these leaders would be blowing those lists out of the water. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, what is it? They just made a heap of money, obviously, with oil, and then they built an enormous sovereign wealth fund. And now they've just got so much money in that sovereign wealth fund that they can just fund whatever. And this is the interesting thing. It's like everybody was criticizing, saying, oh, these mega projects are never going to happen. This is just advertising. It's just Saudi trying to get their name out there. You know, Saudi Arabia, wow. And then The Line's never going to happen. But the thing is that they've got the money sitting in their sovereign wealth fund and they are spending it and this stuff is being built. Like, who knows if it makes its way through to completion or whether plans get scaled back or anything, but they have the money and they are spending it. So I think they are really dead serious about this 2030 vision of becoming a tourism-based economy, more so than oil.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that project is insane. You're talking about that big like wall that their glass wall that they
yeah
it just looks ridiculous
and it's huge, like it's enormous. I can't remember how long it is, right? Let's have a look.
I don't know.
Line Saudi Arabia length, it is going to be the proposal. The line is planned to be 170 kilometers long.
That's crazy.
Like,
how long does that take to build? That's got to take a long time, right?
Multi-generation, like probably,
It's going to take
many generations, I would say, if they actually do what they say they're going
to
do.
That must be what like Egypt used to be like. Like, just doing these incredible projects, which at the time took like decades or like even a century to complete. But I guess no one knew they were doing it. Like, we all get to see because we've got the internet and everything. We get to see, but back then, I guess they probably just, no one else kind of knew. But it is funny to see these crazy projects that don't really mean anything. Like, they're kind of pointless. They're in it's just in the desert. This, like, you know, it, all some of these sky rises you see, like, they just look like it's just so ridiculous. But it is, it's strange. Yeah. Strange.
It's very odd. It's like building a skyscraper, except then the skyscraper's width is 170 kilometers. It just keeps going.
I reckon insane. That was the pitch. That was the pitch. So imagine a big, tall building, but sideways.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, there's quite a few. What's it called? Neom.
Yeah, there's some great videos on the projects that they've done, some of the failed projects that they've done. Like, they keep building they keep building like little islands and off the coast. Like, they dig up sand from the ocean and then build these islands and there's a whole bunch of like projects that they just haven't finished.
It's hectic. It's very interesting. I mean, I like kind of crazy architecture and futuristic building and that. I don't know, it's just like a weird niche that I like. So I actually find this stuff super interesting, and I actually hope they do do it, but my economic brain says, chances are slim. Or if they do, it's going to have to be under 1 liter so that there's no political cancelling and then reinstating and cancelling and reinstating. It's going to have to be under like 1 or 2 liters that really want to do it. And it's going to take a lot of money.
Yep, pretty much, yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, back to it. So Saudi Arabia is going to host the 2034 Soccer World Cup. Cool.
Nice. Fantastic. Yes, Australia's been backing out of project. We backed out of the Commonwealth Games as well, I think, right?
Did we?
Yeah, I think Melbourne was going to have the Commonwealth Games, and then I think we've backed out of that. So yeah, maybe Australia's been trying to be a little bit prudent with their big spending projects. Cut back on some of these things.
Yeah. I love this. Sorry, back to the Saudi stuff. I love this quote being like, it's this Vision 2030 has been described as sports washing. And then the guy's just like, I don't care. It's going to increase my GDP. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, dear. Anyway, that's all I got to talk about for Saudi Arabia.
Nice. There we go.
Yeah. I'd quite like to go to Saudi Arabia, I think. It'll be an interesting place to go and experience. But I like to travel because I want to see like what it's actually like. Because especially places where you hear a lot of things. Like we hear about these human rightsy things with Saudi Arabia. We hear about the grand vision. I'd like to actually just go and have a look for myself. I mean, granted, of course, you're a tourist. You're probably not going to actually see it. But it'd just be interesting to go, I think.
Yeah, it would be interesting to go like Dubai or something and see some of these massive cities that they've built like in the middle of nowhere basically. I think it'd be interesting to see. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about it too much.
All right. Well, there we go. Moving on. What do you got to talk about, Hamish?
Something I have thought a lot about.
Disney and Comcast.
Very specifically, it's that time again where we can the question is being raised, how much will Disney pay Comcast for the final share of Hulu, which I'll get into kind of the details, but Hulu of course is one of the most successful streaming services in the US, 48 million subscribers. They have shows from Fox, ABC, heaps of originals. The Bear, Only Murders in the Building, both really good shows, would highly recommend. I haven't watched all of The Bear, actually, but I watched one episode, and it was pretty good. And then they also have a live TV add-on. And unlike most streamers, they're profitable, which is something, you know, something businesses do sometimes. They reach profitability, and Hulu is one of them. But Disney and Comcast have both owned a share of Hulu for the last few years. I'll get into the details of kind of what the news is, but I first want to kind of go through maybe a little quick history of Hulu, because it's a crazy history. Like this thing has been owned by pretty much everybody. Like anybody in media has like had their fingers on Hulu at some point. It's just a crazy mess. And along the way, you'll kind of see how much of a mess the overall media industry is, with acquisitions here, mergers there, transfer this, spin-off here, IPO here.
It consolidation, is absolute, mate. Consolidation.
That's right. Consolidation. That's the buzz phrase. Yeah. So Hulu was founded in 2007, actually. So it's been around for a really, really long time. It's actually the same year that Netflix launched its streaming service. So they were both kind of launched at the same time. And it started as a joint venture between a couple of big media companies. You had News Corp, you have NBC Universal, and then you have Providence Equity, which is a private equity company that also wanted to kind of get in on the deal. So it just started as a joint venture. A couple of media companies saying, hey, look, this streaming thing.
A couple of mates.
Saying, you know what, this streaming thing might be a thing in the future. So let's, you know, put a little bit of capital to work. None of us has to kind of fully go in on it and take all of the risk. We'll raise it together. We'll raise this Hulu baby together. So it started out News Corp, NBC Universal. In 2009, so a couple of years later, the Walt Disney Company got involved. They weren't a shareholder at the time, but they started to offer some of their content on the platform and started to get a little bit more involved. It was like Disney was kind of, you know, peeking over the fence, being like, hang on. what's News Corp and NBC doing over there? I want involved in some of that. Yeah.
Someone barbecuing?
Exactly. Exactly. The nosy neighbor go over and knock, like, oh, you cooking up a barbecue? hoping for an invite. Yeah, so Disney got involved a little bit in 2009. Then in 2010, the media companies decided let's do an IPO for Hulu. It never actually happened, but they kind of planned to make the company go public. I skipped a bunch of things because it was really convoluted. But there was a few different ownership things that happened. Then in 2016, the next big kind of moment was Time Warner acquired a 10% stake. Time Warner, which later became Warner Media and now Warner Brothers Discovery. So between 2016 and now, it's gone through three different structure changes. So so it's going to be kind of confusing, but it was Time Warner at the time. They took a 10% stake. So again, as I said, another media company goes, what's going on? Let's kind of get involved in this. Then in 2019, Disney, of course, merged with 21st Century Fox. It was an enormous deal. We've spoken about it. Everyone kind of knows about it. 21st Century Fox, which of course was previously owned by News Corp, which meant as a part of the deal, Disney got a 60% stake in Hulu. So that's Disney for the first time getting involved directly in owning Hulu. So now you have Disney owning 60%. You have NBC, which owned, I think it was 30%, and then Warner Media. So it's gone from Time Warner to Warner Media now, had its 10% stake.
Right.
Then in 2019, so later that year, it's still going, later that year, Warner Media said, we're done. We're done with Hulu. And they actually sold the 10% back to the company. It's kind of split evenly between Disney and NBC. Which left the final owners as Disney with a 67% stake and NBC Universal with a 33% stake. NBC, which was previously owned by General Electric, is now owned by Comcast, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay. Definitely now owned by Comcast. I was just trying to think if previously it was General Electric. Yeah, General Electric. I just wrote down here, being an investment banker for media companies must be an absolute nightmare. I mean, there's co-owned assets, companies within companies within companies. Do you remember that scene for The Big Short, the CDO scene, where he's explaining CDOs and he goes, CDO A has parts of CDO B and CDO B has parts of CDO A, and both CDO A and CDO B are within CDO C. We call that CDO squared. And that must be exactly what it's like trying to deal with all of these assets.
I feel like the investment bankers, they're licking their lips because they're like, oh, there's some fees coming up here.
Yeah, there's probably
the more
so much
companies
work.
Involved, the better.
Yeah, so much more work, like so much untangling. That's I'm sure getting billed at a very, very high rate.
Yeah,
that's true. But I can just imagine being like, oh no, not another deal. But the guy who's actually got to go through all of this.
I wanted to retire this year. I guess that's not happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Take another year of my life. And that's actually kind of true. I mean, a lot of these deals do just take a long time. Like they take multiple years because they are just so complicated. But that does bring us to the news this week. So ever since gaining majority share of Hulu, Disney has been looking to buy the remaining 33%. So that they can control the full service. This has been a plan since 2019 when they merged with 21st Century Fox. And they're now in negotiations. And they actually made an agreement back in 2019. So when the acquisition was made, there was kind of a deal between the two companies that said that Disney would ultimately be buying the remaining 33% stake. They kind of left the negotiations they pushed it out into the future, but they said, yes, we'll agree that we're going to come back to the table and negotiate. And at the time, they basically just set a minimum price, purchase price, which was about $9 billion for the 33% stake, which they kind of set back then. It's actually funny. The actual purchase price is also now this is just a side note. It's also $500 million less than they previously agreed because Comcast, which owns a share in Hulu, they had some obligations to make investments in Hulu. They just didn't pay $500 million to Disney. That's just a side note. That Comcast just decided not to, like, you know, some people try and, like, they forget to pay parking fines. Like, imagine forgetting to pay or intentionally not paying $500 million.
Jeez.
Which,
were we supposed to pay? Hang on. Frank, were we supposed to, when was that due?
It's crazy. Yeah. I don't think it was an accident. I think it was,
No,
I think it was an intentional move to retain $500 million.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was a funny side note to this story. It's like the numbers we're talking are insane. And like, I love how that was just like a footnote in like the story. It's like, oh yeah, they didn't pay $500 million.
Asterisk, the missing $500 million? Yeah, we held on to that.
Yeah. Well, we found it.
You can thank us later, shareholders.
Yeah.
Hectic.
So now they're kind of at the negotiation table. You've got Disney, which is using JP Morgan to determine the value of Hulu. Comcast is using Morgan Stanley. So they both have their own investment banks that run the numbers, go through, untangle everything, work out what they think it's worth. Then they both come back to the table. They show each other what their appraisals are. And if the two sides' valuations are outside of 10%, so if there's a 10% differential or more, then they have to get They go to the next stage, which is they need a third appraiser, like a third kind of mediator, I guess, in the middleman that then ultimately decides the price. Because this is because they've already got an agreement to make this sale. So
right.
That's basically what we'll see. I think it's the 1st of December, I think, is when they both come and kind of show, I think. I might get that wrong, but right. Where they'll show each other the valuation and hopefully it's within 10% of each other and then they can do some further negotiation and reach a sale price. But that's happening. Disney will be making that purchase. It's obviously great for Disney. It means that they can make some deals become a lot easier for them to make with complete 100% control. Although it is going to be a bit of a squeeze on them. They only have $11 billion in cash and the sale price is expected to be about $9 billion. So it's almost all their cash. And they already have $47 billion in debt from the mostly from the 21st century merger. They're in a, you know, they're getting squeezed. They have obviously an enormous amount of assets now. They have this huge, they're so much bigger than they were before the 21st century deal. They have some great streaming services that they're building, but yeah, financially they've kind of pushed themselves like right to the edge in terms of what they can afford.
Interesting. One thing you mentioned before, you mentioned before how long some of these deals can take to get through. I actually looked at, I was just in the background looking at when Disney first, or when Bob Iger first started discussing with Murdoch the idea of a 21st Century Fox acquisition. And it was in August of 2017.
Right.
And then the official acquisition date was March the 20th, 2019. So quite a while away. And then that's not even the thing. That's like just when they shake it. That's when it's official. But then you actually have to integrate the companies into one another, which took Disney another few quarters at least to actually get. When they talk about, you know, working on the consolidation of 21st or the merger of 21st, like they're still trying to slot it into their business. It can take a while.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
I just can't even fathom how they even do that. Like,
The logistics of it.
Yeah. Just the logistics of like the files, just everything,
employees,
company structures. Like, obviously it's not just like, you're not just moving one thing.
Goals.
Over. A lot of it is, you know, integrating into Disney's business. So people get fired, new people are hired. You know, you have maybe now you have two managers that will be fighting for the same position. You know, it's kind of consolidated into what it would just be. I just can't fathom how complex some of these, you know, $50, $60 billion deals are.
Yeah, it's crazy. Pretty hectic. It'd be hard, especially being like working for Murdoch and 21st Century Fox, and you've got your goals. You know what your company is working towards for the year. You know you're trying to get this out at this date. You're working towards this next year and that. And then all of a sudden, you've got to try and Disney comes in and says, actually, we're working towards this and we don't want you to do that, but we do want you to keep doing this. And then it's just like, what am I doing? Yeah, it'd be hard. Like, obviously, if you're just a ground level worker, your job probably wouldn't change very much. But yeah, actually being one of the higher ups and figuring that out, that would be difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could be working towards plans for multiple years and then all of a sudden it's just kind of upended. So
yeah, tricky.
So yeah, there you go. It's the latest saga in the complex media landscape. It just made me laugh looking through the history. Yeah. It's like, oh, this used to be this, and then it turned into that, and then it turned into that, and then it was spun off into this and bought by them. And it's just like, what is going on?
And it's landed with Disney.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a crazy landscape. Everyone's just shuffling assets around and hopefully getting the right mix.
I'm waiting for the arc of when Disney fully acquire Hulu and then in 3 years it's underperforming and Comcast buy back in. they buy like 33% back for X amount of dollars. And
Warner Brothers Discovery buys them. Or Hulu buys Warner and then...
Hulu buys Warner Brothers Discovery. Oh, that would be classic. The hunter becomes the hunted. Yeah. All right, Hamish. That's it. Should we move on?
Yep. Tell us.
We haven't got that long left. So I'll just talk about SpaceX quite quickly.
Yeah.
SpaceX and ULA win more Space Force launches. Remember when Space Force was just like, I think Donald Trump announced it and we were like,
yeah, the name is so good.
Yeah. And now it's a real thing. Yeah. So the US Space Force assigned 21 rocket launches to SpaceX and United Launch Alliance worth about $2.5 billion in total. So Space Force's Space Systems Command on Tuesday announced the mission assignments, which represent the last round of orders under a multi-year program called National Security Space Launch Phase 2. So sounds very convoluted. NSSL, the National Security Space Launch Phase 2, is essentially just the US booking in launches so that they can assure that the US Department of Defense and more broadly just the US government always has access to space. They always have access to space launches that they need. So the final batch of assignments were split almost evenly, according to Colonel Doug Pentecost, the Deputy Program Chief Executive Officer of the Space Force's Space Systems Command. ULA received 11 missions, valued at $1.3 billion. SpaceX received 10 missions, valued at $1.23 billion. Right. Space Systems Command said the missions are scheduled to launch over the next 2 to 3 years. ULA, a joint venture of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, will use its soon-to-debut Vulcan rocket for the 11 missions, while SpaceX will fly 7 missions with its Falcon 9 rocket and 3 with its Falcon Heavy rocket, which is essentially just 3 Falcon 9s strapped together. Originally, Phase 2 was to consist of 34 missions, this NSSL Phase 2. It was originally going to consist of 34 missions. Space Force had previously announced that of mission assignments, 60% would go to ULA, 40% to SpaceX, but increased demand for national security launches grew Phase 2, and Space Force has been assigned 48 missions over the course of the program. In the end, Phase 2 was closer to an even split, with Elon Musk's company receiving contracts for 22 missions to ULA's 26 missions, or a 46 share to 54. So there you go.
Big money
in space launch for the US government.
Interesting. I don't know too much about SpaceX and how all of this works. Is government contracts like most of their business or this is mostly that? And then they obviously launch their own stuff, right? They launch like Starlink and that sort of thing. And then is there other companies as well that use their rockets to launch satellites and that sort of thing, or not really?
Yeah. So the way it works is, so SpaceX was on the brink and they got saved by NASA. They got funding from NASA. Right. And so that's initially their missions were, they were paid by NASA to send up, resupply the International Space Station. And then from there, with that money, they've kind of built out their business. They obviously now have the Falcon 9, which is a very reliable rocket.
Yeah.
And that they essentially launch companies' satellites into space. They offer the launch service for companies that want to launch their satellites into space. They have contracts with NASA continually to resupply the ISS.
Right.
And they also have government contracts, defense contracts to launch military stuff. And then beyond that, you're exactly right. Over the last couple of years, they've been focused on another arm of revenue generation to be a little bit more, you know, self-sustaining, and that is to use their launch capabilities to create a global satellite internet business, which is Starlink.
Yeah, interesting. Are they like...
Yeah.
I wonder, like, how do restrictions work for satellites? Because they're just, like, they're just orbiting, right? So...
Yeah.
I think... who decides whether they could launch and, like, who owns the space? And I mean, I guess there's so much... There's so much room, right? So I guess it's not really a problem. Like,
it's not.
But would it eventually become a problem, or is that just not a thing?
No, probably not. Probably not.
There would never be a
satellites aren't big enough.
Yeah, right. Nah, okay.
Satellites just aren't big enough. And you think about the circumference of the Earth.
Mm.
Well, I mean,
like the
circumference.
Area.
Yeah, so. Yeah, well, no, the circumference. And you think, well, even you can think of just the radius. The radius from the center of the Earth to where we are on the Earth's crust. And then you can even add a little bit more onto that because it's up in space. So they've actually got a bigger space to work with, no pun intended, than the actual surface of the Earth.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like an enormous surface area, way bigger than even the surface of the Earth. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And there is not, you think there's how many billions of people? Like most satellites these days aren't much bigger than a person with their arms out like that.
Right, right.
And, yeah, and there's certainly not 8 billion satellites out there.
That is true.
I mean, the whole of people are getting annoyed at Starlink because they're going to have like tens of thousands of satellites out there. They're not very big satellites.
Yeah.
But they're going to have tens of thousands. And people were actually being like, oh, we're not going to be able to see the moon anymore. It's like, no, you idiot. It's like you could put hundreds, you could put millions of these satellites that you're still going to be able to see the moon. It's fine.
Yeah, true. So, I guess, yeah.
So silly.
Interesting. But, yeah. Right. So there you go. Wow.
There you go. Yeah. Sorry. Bit of a SpaceX tangent. I find it very interesting. To answer your question, like how do they, who owns the space? Like, I don't really know. Like, how does it work? Like, obviously, they can't do much about it. Like, if the US just sends up satellites, the other countries can't really do much about it because how are they going to get it down?
It's like, that's true, yeah.
Stop flying over the top of our country.
Yeah, but, like, what's going to happen?
All right, take the satellite down. Go on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, how could they even do anything? But space is one thing. What if they actually go to Mars? Yeah. Like, is that just going to be, like, a claim the land? Like, are they going to be... Are there going to be fights over over who gets what?
I think technically there's like some treaty that says no country owns any planets beyond like what they own on Earth. But yeah, it's like, you know, if Elon Musk gets there first, it's like, oh, I'm claiming this land is mine. Come stop me. Yeah. It's like, it's interesting that the fundamental limiting factor is that they literally can't stop it. Like, they don't have the capability to get to Mars. Like, if Elon Musk gets there first, then he could literally just chill out on Mars being like, well, come on, come claim it. And no one will be able to reach him.
Yeah, yeah.
No one has the capability.
That's that is kind of funny. Yeah, it's like the country or the nation that could build like the boat that could, or the ship that could finally go to some of these new lands. It was theirs, you know?
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly right, Hamish. Alrighty, should we do a Q&A question or two?
Yeah, let's see what we got here.
As a reminder, if you want to ask a question for Q&A, head to the most recent episode of the podcast on YouTube and drop us a comment, or hit us up in the Spotify question box. Is that what it's called?
Yep. Just scroll up in the app and ask your questions there. Okay, we'll start at the top. Did you guys ever mention your goals for investing, goals at the start versus now? We haven't really spoken about that recently, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. For my investing, my goals originally were just to achieve financial freedom as soon as possible. That's what I wanted to do. And financial freedom for me, like, I have all these ideas, like even with the YouTube channel, I got all these ideas that I want to try and explore. But my brain somewhat pulls me back because I don't have, you know, my house paid off yet, you know, the car paid. So I wanted to invest to try and accelerate myself to a position where I've, you know, I've got an apartment, I've got my house, I've got my car, all of the major things that you kind of need to tick off in life, I've kind of ticked them off. Yeah. So that anything beyond that, you know, I can experiment, I can try and build businesses, I can try and do this and that. And if I fail, it's not like shattering. Like it would suck, but it's not going to cripple me.
Yeah.
And it would give me the opportunity to be able to take those risks and try different things with my life, things that I wanted to try. So that was my goals. But now I'm kind of more of my investing now is into this business more so than say the stock market, which is kind of funny because at the start I was investing in the stock market, and over time I kind of feel like, you know, like I'm not even practicing what I'm preaching anymore, because for me, I guess it's still investing, but I found it better to invest in my own business as opposed to the stock market.
It's a bit weird. Well, it is funny though, because that tends to happen. I mean, if you have a business, then you know, usually it's a smaller business than the ones you're investing in, probably. So the opportunities to invest and generate high returns are usually just going to be in your own business for a very long time. Just because there's just so many like growth levers that you can pull with the money that you're kind of deploying. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I don't know. Investing goals, I'm trying to think if I had any kind of specific goals when I started. I think once I kind of just realized like the power of compounding, that you can just, as long as you're consistently putting in a little bit, very quickly you can build quite substantial wealth. I think it just made logical sense to do it. In terms of motivation, I think it's just a good idea to build wealth to protect against the unknowns. Because I think there's just so many things, especially if you've seen like family members or something go through some kind of like health problem that is like a sudden spike in expenses. It just makes you like, I don't know. I think it's just a smart thing to do, to just have, have one of your major goals be to build wealth so that you can, you know, stomach those unexpected expenses that, you know, you don't really think about on a day to day, but they can just come up out of nowhere. So I think that was probably my motivation. Nothing's really changed all that much.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I can't really say, like, I'm trying to think, like, I don't think I have any like really strong goals. It just made rational sense. Just invest broadly into the market. I have some individual investments as well, but you know, both of those are going at the same time, and it just makes sense. Yeah. There's not really any like crazy goal. I'm not trying to retire early. I don't have like a FIRE, you know, financial independence, retire early. I'm not into that or anything. It's just, you know, having, you know, when I produce income, having somewhere to put it where it's, you know, most effectively being used, rather than just all sitting in a savings account, you know, making sure
build your safety net.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I like it. Yeah, I think it's interesting. We could probably get into this on a whole nother episode. Like the science, I don't know, goal setting, like everybody's like, yeah, goal setting's so important. But I'm also in the camp of like, goal setting sometimes just doesn't matter so much. I think it works for some people. Like if you're like a lazy person that really struggles for motivation to do certain things, like you need to have a goal. Like, okay, I need to retire with this amount, and I need to have that goal because otherwise I'm never going to get there, and I need to break it down into short-term goals. But for me, I've never actually, because I'm naturally very driven and competitive and I want to excel in whatever I do, I don't actually need goals. Like I kind of know, I know where I'm going.
Yeah.
And I know that I just need to, I know just naturally like what I need to do to get there. So.
Yeah. I've never been a big goal setter. I just think a lot of the time you set goals and it's not, the goal isn't something you can actually control. Like, oh, I want to make this much money, or I want to reach this, you know, milestone. You can't control that. So I tend to focus on what you can control, which is the system, building systems, building, you know, the day-to-day of what you do, which will, you know, you're like puts you on the path towards the goal.
Generally where you want to be.
Where you want to be. Because then you actually, you know, your brain power is being used on making sure you're doing the day-to-day stuff rather than just kind of hoping for this goal. And that's generally what I do with everything.
Yeah.
Like I have a structure for how I invest, whether it's broadly or individual companies, but I don't really have any goals. Like, I want to hit this financial number, hit this number in my account by this time, because there's just, who knows what's going to happen along the way. Same with income. I don't really have income goals or anything like that.
Yeah.
I just try and do the day-to-day stuff well.
Yeah. And that's the same, like, not to drown on too much, like YouTubers are like, oh, how many subs do you want to have by the end of next year? I'm like, I don't know. That's so out of my hands.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather focus on how many videos am I going to make next year?
Yeah. Or and the quality of the videos and, like, you know, things that are within your control that will ultimately lead to those outcomes. Yeah.
Even things like trying to put numbers on stock, like the future of the stock market is unknown.
Yeah.
So to say I want to have this amount of money by this age, it's like that's out of your control. If you're using the stock market, that you don't know. The stock market might give that to you. It might not. We don't know what the future holds. We know that generally over a long period of time, the stock market can help us build wealth. And I think that's as specific as you can kind of get.
And if you get like an unexpected large expense and then you don't hit the goal, that's not your fault. Like that doesn't, like you'll miss the goal and you'll feel like you did something wrong when you didn't. Like just as long as you were doing all of the things along the way right, that's more important. You don't want to set something that makes you feel like you missed it, even though something out of your control was the reason you didn't hit it, which happens all the time. I'm not a big goal guy, that's for sure.
Maybe we'll have like a behavioral psychologist school us in the comments or something like this. But, but anyway, that's our washed opinion on goal setting, everybody.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't try. Don't even try.
You know, aim low and avoid disappointment, I say. all right, we're getting out of here, guys. Thanks very much for tuning in, as always. Keep sending in your questions and we'll keep giving our washed opinions. thanks always, Hamish, for joining me.
No worries.
Thanks, guys, for listening in. Hopefully you got some sort of value out of that. Oh, dear. And we'll see you guys next week.
See you, guys.